This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents a series of unfortunate events. Book the First, The Bad Beginning, by Lemony Snicket. If you are interested in stories with happy endings, you would be better off listening to some other program. In this story, not only is there no happy ending, there is no happy beginning, and very few happy things in the middle. This is because not very many happy things happened in the lives of the three Baudelaire youngsters. Violet, Klaus, and Sunny Baudelaire were intelligent children, and they were charming and resourceful, and had pleasant facial features, but they were extremely unlucky, and most everything that happened to them was rife with misfortune, misery, and despair. I'm sorry to tell you this, but that is how the story goes. Their misfortune began one day at Briny Beach. The three Baudelaire children lived with their parents in an enormous mansion at the heart of a dirty and busy city. And occasionally, their parents gave them permission to take a rickety trolley alone to the seashore, where they would spend the day as a sort of vacation, as long as they were home for dinner. The word rickety, you probably know, here means unsteady, or likely to collapse. This particular morning, it was grey and cloudy, which didn't bother the Baudelaire youngsters one bit. When it was hot and sunny, Briny Beach was crowded with tourists, and it was impossible to find a good place to lay one's blanket. On grey and cloudy days, the Baudelaires had the beach to themselves to do what they liked. Violet Baudelaire, the eldest, liked to skip rocks. Like most 14-year-olds, she was right-handed, so the rocks skipped farther across the murky water when Violet used her right hand than when she used her left. As she skipped rocks, she was looking out at the horizon and thinking about an invention she wanted to build. Anyone who knew Violet well could tell she was thinking hard, because her long hair was tied up in a ribbon to keep it out of her eyes. Violet had a real knack for inventing and building strange devices, so her brain was often filled with images of pulleys, levers, and gears, and she never wanted to be distracted by something as trivial as her hair. This morning, she was thinking about how to construct a device that could retrieve a rock after you had skipped it into the ocean. Klaus Baudelaire, the middle child and the only boy, liked to examine creatures in tide pools. Klaus was a little older than 12 and wore glasses, which made him look intelligent. He was intelligent. The Baudelaire parents had an enormous library in their mansion, a room filled with thousands of books on nearly every subject. Being only 12, Klaus, of course, had not read all of the books in the Baudelaire library, but he had read a great many of them and had retained a lot of the information from his readings. He knew how to tell an alligator from a crocodile. He knew who killed Julius Caesar. And he knew much about the tiny, slimy animals found at Briny Beach, which he was examining now. Sunny Baudelaire, the youngest, liked to bite things. She was an infant and very small for her age, scarcely larger than a boot. What she lacked in size, however, she made up for with the size and sharpness of her four teeth. Sunny was at an age where one mostly speaks in a series of unintelligible shrieks. except when she used the few actual words in her vocabulary, like bottle, mommy, and bite. Most people had trouble understanding what it was that Sunny was saying. For instance, this morning she was saying, gack, over and over, which probably meant, look at that mysterious figure emerging from the fog. Sure enough, in the distance along the misty shore of Briny Beach, there could be seen a tall figure striding toward the Baudelaire children. Sunny had already been staring and shrieking at the figure for some time when Klaus looked up from the spiny crab he was examining and saw it too. He reached over and touched Violet's arm, bringing her out of her inventing thoughts.
Look at that!
The figure was drawing closer, and the children could see a few details. It was about the size of an adult, except its head was tall and rather square.
What do you think it is?
I don't know, but it seems to be moving right toward us.
We're alone on the beach. There's nobody else it could be moving toward.
Violet felt the slender, smooth stone in her left hand, which she had been about to try to skip as far as she could. She had a sudden thought to throw it at the figure, because it seemed so frightening.
It only seemed scary because of all the mist.
This was true. As the figure reached them, the children saw with relief that it was not anybody frightening at all, but somebody they knew, Mr. Poe. Mr. Poe was a friend of Mr. and Mrs. Baudelaire's, whom the children had met many times at dinner parties.
A toast, please.
Ah.
To your bright eyes.
One of the things Violet, Klaus and Sunny really liked about their parents was that they didn't send their children away when they had company over, but allowed them to join the adults at the dinner table and participate in the conversation, as long as they helped clear the table. The children remembered Mr. Poe because he always had a cold and was constantly excusing himself from the table to have a fit of coughing in the next room. Mr. Poe took off his top hat, which had made his head look large and square in the fog, and stood for a moment, coughing loudly into a white handkerchief. Violet and Klaus moved forward to shake his hand and say, "How do you do?"
How do you do? How do you do?
Oh, thank you.
How fine, thank you.
The children wondered what Mr. Poe was doing there at Briny Beach, when he should have been at the bank in the city, where he worked. He was not dressed for the beach.
It's a nice day.
Sunny made a noise that sounded like an angry bird, and Klaus picked her up and held her.
Yes, it is a nice day. I'm afraid I have some very bad news for you children.
The three Baudelaire siblings looked at him. Violet, with some embarrassment, felt the stone in her left hand and was glad she had not thrown it at Mr. Poe.
Your parents have perished in a terrible fire.
The children didn't say anything.
They perished in a fire that destroyed the entire house. I'm very, very sorry to tell you this, my dears.
Violet took her eyes off Mr. Poe and stared out at the ocean. Mr. Poe had never called the Baudelaire children my dears before. She understood the words he was saying, but thought he must be joking, playing a terrible joke on her and her brother and sister.
Perished means killed.
We know what the word perished means.
Klaus did know what the word perished meant, but he was still having trouble understanding exactly what it was that Mr. Poe had said. It seemed to him that Mr. Poe must somehow have misspoken.
The fire department arrived, of course, but they were too late. The entire house was engulfed in fire. It burned to the ground.
Klaus pictured all the books in the library going up in flames. Now he'd never read them all.
I was sent to retrieve you here and to take you to my home, where you'll stay for some time while we figure things out. I am the executor of your parents' estate. That means I will be handling their enormous fortune and figuring out where you children will go. When Violet comes of age, the fortune will be yours, but the bank will take charge of it until you're old enough.
Although he said he was the executor, Violet felt like Mr. Poe was the executioner. He had simply walked down the beach to them and changed their lives forever.
Come with me.
Mr. Poe held out his hand. In order to take it, Violet had to drop the stone she was holding. Klaus took Violet's other hand, and Sunny took Klaus's other hand, and in that manner, the three Baudelaire children, the Baudelaire orphans now, were led away from the beach and from their previous lives. It is useless for me to describe to you how terrible Violet, Klaus, and even Sunny felt in the time that followed. If you have ever lost someone very important to you, then you already know how it feels, and if you haven't, you cannot possibly imagine it. For the Baudelaire children, it was, of course, especially terrible, because they had lost both their parents at the same time, and for several days they felt so miserable they could scarcely get out of bed. Klaus found he had little interest in books. The gears in Violet's inventive brain seemed to stop. And even Sunny, who of course was too young to really understand what was going on, bit things with less enthusiasm. Of course, it didn't make things any easier that they had lost their home as well, and all their possessions. As I'm sure you know, to be in one's own room, in one's own bed, can often make a bleak situation a little better. But the beds of the Baudelaire orphans have been reduced to charred rubble. Mr. Poe had taken them to the remains of the Baudelaire mansion to see if anything had been unharmed, and it was terrible. Violet's microscope had fused together in the heat of the fire. Klaus's favorite pen had turned to ash, and all of Sunny's teething rings had melted. Here and there, the children could see traces of the enormous home they had loved. Fragments of their grand piano, an elegant bottle in which Mr. Baudelaire kept brandy, the scorched cushion of the window seat where their mother liked to sit and read. Their home destroyed, the Baudelaires had to recuperate from their terrible loss in the Poe household, which was not at all agreeable. Mr. Poe was scarcely at home, because he was very busy attending to the Baudelaire affairs, and when he was home, he was often coughing so much he could barely have a conversation. Mrs. Poe purchased clothing for the orphans that was in grotesque colours and itched, and the two Poe children, Edgar and Albert, were loud and obnoxious boys, with whom the Baudelaires had to share a tiny room that smelled of some sort of ghastly flower. But even given the surroundings, the children had mixed feelings when, over a dull dinner of boiled chicken, boiled potatoes, and blanched, the word blanched here means boiled, string beans, Mr. Poe announced that they were to leave his household the next morning.
Good. Now we can get our room back. I'm tired of sharing it. Violet and Klaus are always moping around and are never any fun.
And the baby bites.
Edgar tossed a chicken bone to the floor as if he were an animal in a zoo and not the son of a well-respected member of the banking community.
Where will we go?
I have made arrangements for you to be raised by a distant relative of yours who lives on the other side of town. His name is Count Olaf.
Violet, Klaus, and Sunny looked at one another, unsure of what to think. On one hand, they didn't want to live with the Poes any longer. On the other hand, they had never heard of Count Olaf and didn't know what he would be like.
Your parents' will instructs that you be raised in the most convenient way possible. Here in the city, you'll be used to your surroundings, and this Count Olaf is the only relative who lives within the urban limits.
Klaus thought this over for a minute as he swallowed a chewy bit of bean.
But our parents never mentioned Count Olaf to us. Just how is he related to us, exactly?
Mr. Poe sighed and looked down at Sunny, who was biting a fork and listening closely.
He is either a third cousin 4 times removed or a fourth cousin 3 times removed. He is not your closest relative on the family tree, but he is the closest geographically. That's why...
If he lives in the city, why didn't our parents ever invite him over?
Possibly because he was very busy. He's an actor by trade and often travels around the world with various theater companies.
I thought he was a count.
He is both a count and an actor. Now, I don't mean to cut short our dinner, but you children have to pack up your things, and I have to return to the bank to catch up on work. Like your new legal guardian, I am very busy myself.
The three Baudelaire children had many more questions for Mr. Poe, but he had already stood up from the table and with a slight wave of his hand, departed from the room. They heard him coughing into his handkerchief, and then the front door creaked shut as he left the house.
Well, you three had better start packing. Edgar, Albert, please help me clear the table.
The Baudelaire orphans went to the bedroom and glumly packed their few belongings. Klaus looked distastefully at each ugly shirt Mrs. Poe had bought for him as he folded them and put them into a small suitcase. Violet looked around the cramped, smelly room in which they had been living. And Sunny crawled around solemnly, biting each of Edgar and Albert's shoes, leaving small teeth marks in each one so she would not be forgotten. From time to time, the Baudelaire children looked at one another. But with their future such a mystery, they could think of nothing to say. At bedtime, they tossed and turned all night, scarcely getting any sleep between the loud snoring of Edgar and Albert and their own worried thoughts. Finally, Mr. Poe knocked on the door and stuck his head into the bedroom.
Rise and shine, Baudelaires. It's time for you to go to Count Olaf's.
Violet looked around the crowded bedroom, and even though she didn't like it, she felt very nervous about leaving.
Do we have to go right this minute?
Yes, you do. I'm dropping you off on my way to the bank, so we need to leave as soon as possible. Please get out of bed and get dressed.
Mr. Poe spoke briskly. The word briskly here means quickly, so as to get the Baudelaire children to leave the house. The Baudelaire children left the house. Mr. Poe's automobile rumbled along the cobblestone streets of the city toward the neighborhood where Count Olaf lived. They passed horse-drawn carriages and motorcycles along Doldrum Drive. They passed the fickle fountain, an elaborately carved monument that occasionally spat out water in which young children played. They passed an enormous pile of dirt where the royal gardens once stood. Before too long, Mr. Poe drove his car down a narrow alley lined with houses made of pale brick and stopped halfway down the block.
Here we are, your new home.
The Baudelaire children looked out and saw the prettiest house on the block. The bricks had been cleaned very well, and through the wide and open windows, one could see an assortment of well-groomed plants. Standing in the doorway, with her hand on the shiny brass doorknob, was an older woman, smartly dressed, who was smiling at the children. In one hand, she carried a flower pot.
Hello there. You must be the children Count Olaf is adopting.
Violet opened the door of the automobile and got out to shake the woman's hand. It felt firm and warm, and for the first time in a long while, Violet felt as if her life and the lives of her siblings might turn out well after all.
Yes, we are. I am Violet Baudelaire, and this is my brother Klaus and my sister Sunny, and this is Mr. Poe, who has been arranging things for us since the death of our parents.
Yes, I heard about the accident. I am Justice Strauss.
That's an unusual first name.
It is my title, not my first name. I serve as a judge on the High Court.
How fascinating. And are you married to Count Olaf?
Oh, goodness me, no. I don't actually know him that well. He is my next-door neighbor.
The children looked from the well-scrubbed house of Justice Strauss to the dilapidated one next door. The bricks were stained with soot and grime. There were only two small windows, which were closed with the shades drawn, even though it was a nice day. Rising above the windows was a tall and dirty tower that tilted slightly to the left. The front door needed to be repainted, and carved in the middle of it was an image of an eye. The entire building sagged to the side like a crooked tooth. Everyone knew exactly what Sunny meant. She meant, what a terrible place. I didn't want to live there at all.
Well, it was nice to meet you.
Oh, yes. Perhaps one day you could come over and help me with my gardening.
That would be very pleasant.
It would, of course, be very pleasant to help Justice Strauss with her gardening. But Violet could not help thinking that it would be far more pleasant to live in Justice Strauss's house instead of Count Olaf's. What kind of a man, Violet wondered, would carve an image of an eye into his front door? Mr. Poe tipped his hat to Justice Strauss, who smiled at the children and disappeared into her lovely house. Klaus stepped forward and knocked on Count Olaf's door, his knuckles rapping right in the middle of the carved eye. There was a pause, and then the door creaked open, and the children saw Count Olaf for the first time.
Hello, hello, hello.
He was very tall and very thin, dressed in a grey suit that had many dark stains on it. His face was unshaven, and rather than two eyebrows, like most human beings have, he had just one big one. His eyes were very, very shiny, which made him look both hungry and angry.
Hello, my children. Please step into your new home and wipe your feet outside so no mud gets indoors.
As they stepped into the house, Mr. Poe behind them, the Baudelaire orphans realized what a ridiculous thing Count Olaf had just said. The room in which they found themselves was the dirtiest they had ever seen, and a little bit of mud from outdoors wouldn't have made a bit of difference. Even by the dim light of the one bare light bulb that hung from the ceiling, the three children could see that everything in this room was filthy. From the stuffed head of a lion, which was nailed to the wall, to the bowl of apple cores, which sat on a small wooden table. Klaus willed himself not to cry as he looked around.
This room looks like it needs a little work.
Mr. Poe peered around in the gloom.
I realize that my humble home isn't as fancy as the Baudelaire mansion, but perhaps with a bit of your money we could fix it up a little nicer.
The Baudelaire fortune will not be used for such matters. In fact, it will not be used at all until Violet is of age.
Count Olaf turned to Mr. Poe with a glint in his eye like an angry dog. For a moment, Violet thought he was going to strike Mr. Poe across the face, but then he swallowed. The children could see his Adam's apple bob in his skinny throat and shrugged his patchy shoulders.
All right, then. It's the same to me. Thank you very much, Mr. Poe, for bringing them here. Children, I will now show you to your room.
Goodbye, Violet, Klaus, and Sunny. I hope you will be very happy here. I will continue to see you occasionally, and you can always contact me at the bank if you have any questions.
But we don't even know where the bank is.
I have a map of the city. Goodbye, Mr. Poe.
Oh.
He leaned forward to shut the door, and the Baudelaire orphans were too overcome with despair to get a last glimpse of Mr. Poe. They now wished they could all stay at the Poe household, even though it smelled. Rather than looking at the door, then, the orphans looked down and saw that, although Count Olaf was wearing shoes, he wasn't wearing any socks. They could see, in the space of pale skin between his tattered trouser cuff and his black shoe, that Count Olaf had an image of an eye tattooed on his ankle, matching the eye on his front door. They wondered how many other eyes were in Count Olaf's house, and whether for the rest of their lives, they would always feel as though Count Olaf were watching them, even when he wasn't nearby. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but first impressions are often entirely wrong. You can look at a painting for the first time, for example, and not like it at all. But after looking at it a little longer, you may find it very pleasing. The first time you try Gorgonzola cheese, you may find it too strong, but when you are older, you may want to eat nothing but Gorgonzola cheese. Klaus, when Sunny was born, did not like her at all. But by the time she was 6 weeks old, the two of them were thick as thieves. Your initial opinion on just about anything may change over time. I wish I could tell you that the Baudelaire's first impressions of Count Olaf and his house were incorrect, as first impressions so often are. But these impressions, that Count Olaf was a horrible person and his house a depressing pigsty, were absolutely correct. During the first few days after the orphans' arrival at Count Olaf's, Violet, Klaus and Sunny attempted to make themselves feel at home, but it was really no use. Even though Count Olaf's house was quite large, the three children were placed together in one filthy bedroom that had only one small bed in it. Violet and Klaus took turns sleeping in it, so that every other night one of them was in the bed and the other was sleeping on the hard wooden floor. And the bed's mattress was so lumpy, it was difficult to say who was more uncomfortable. To make a bed for Sunny, Violet removed the dusty curtains from the curtain rod that hung over the bedroom's one window and bunched them together to form a sort of cushion, just big enough for her sister. However, without curtains over the cracked glass, the sun streamed through the window every morning, so the children woke up early and sore each day. Instead of a closet, there was a large cardboard box that had once held a refrigerator and would now hold the three children's clothes, all piled in a heap. Instead of toys, books, or other things to amuse the youngsters, Count Olaf had provided a small pile of rocks. And the only decoration on the peeling walls was a large and ugly painting of an eye, matching the one on Count Olaf's ankle and all over the house. But the children knew, as I'm sure you know, that the worst surroundings in the world can be tolerated if the people in them are interesting and kind. Count Olaf was neither interesting nor kind. He was demanding, short-tempered, and bad-smelling. The only good thing to be said for Count Olaf is that he wasn't around very often. When the children woke up and chose their clothing out of the refrigerator box, they would walk into the kitchen and find a list of instructions left for them by Count Olaf, who would often not appear until nighttime. Most of the day, he spent out of the house or up in the high tower where the children were forbidden to go. The instructions he left for them were usually difficult chores such as repainting the back porch or repairing the windows. And instead of a signature, Count Olaf would draw an eye at the bottom of the note.
My theater troupe will be coming for dinner before tonight's performance. Have dinner ready for all 10 of them by the time they arrive at 7 o'clock. Buy the food, prepare it, set the table, serve dinner, clean up afterwards, and stay out of our way.
Below that, there was the usual eye, and underneath the note was a small sum of money for the groceries. Violet and Klaus read the note as they ate their breakfast, which was a grey and lumpy oatmeal Count Olaf left for them each morning in a large pot on the stove. Then they looked at each other in dismay.
None of us knows how to cook.
That's true. I know how to repair those windows and how to clean the chimney because those sorts of things interest me. but I don't know how to cook anything except toast.
And sometimes you burn the toast.
They smiled, remembering a time when the two of them got up early to make a special breakfast for their parents. Violet had burnt the toast, and their parents, smelling smoke, had run downstairs to see what the matter was. When they saw Violet and Klaus looking forlornly at pieces of pitch-black toast, they laughed and laughed, and then made pancakes for the whole family.
I wish they were here. They would never let us stay in this dreadful place.
If they were here, we would not be with Count Olaf in the first place. I hate it here, Violet. I hate this house. I hate our room. I hate having to do all these chores. And I hate Count Olaf.
I hate it, too.
Klaus looked at his older sister with relief. Sometimes just saying that you hate something and having someone agree with you can make you feel better about a terrible situation.
I hate everything about our lives right now, Klaus, but we have to keep our chin up.
This was an expression the children's father had used, and it meant try to stay cheerful.
You're right, but it is very difficult to keep one's chin up when Count Olaf keeps shoving it down.
Yuck!
Sunny banged on the table with her oatmeal spoon. Violet and Klaus looked once again at Count Olaf's note.
Perhaps we could find a cookbook and read about how to cook. It shouldn't be that difficult to make a simple meal.
Violet and Klaus spent several minutes opening and shutting Count Olaf's kitchen cupboards, but there weren't any cookbooks to be found.
I can't say I'm surprised. We haven't found any books in this house at all.
I know. I miss reading very much. We must go out and look for a library sometime soon.
But not today. Today we have to cook for 10 people.
At that moment, there was a knock on the front door. Violet and Klaus looked at one another nervously.
Who in the world would want to visit Count Olaf?
Maybe someone wants to visit us.
In the time since the Baudelaire parents' death, most of the Baudelaire orphans' friends had fallen by the wayside. An expression which here means they stopped calling, writing, and stopping by to see any of the Baudelaires, making them very lonely. You and I, of course, would never do this to any of our grieving acquaintances, but it is a sad truth in life that when someone has lost a loved one, friends sometimes avoid the person, just when the presence of friends is most needed. Violet, Klaus, and Sunny walked slowly to the front door and peered through the peephole, which was in the shape of an eye. They were delighted to see Justice Strauss peering back at them and opened the door.
Justice Strauss, how lovely to see you.
She was about to add, "Do come in," but then she realized that Justice Strauss would not want to venture into the dim and dirty room.
Please forgive me for not stopping by sooner. I wanted to see how you children were settling in. But I had a very difficult case in the High Court, and it was taking up much of my time.
What sort of case was it?
Having been deprived of reading, Klaus was hungry for new information.
I can't really discuss it, because it's official business. But I can tell you it concerns a poisonous plant and illegal use of someone's credit card.
This appeared to mean, how interesting. Although, of course, there's no way that Sunny could understand what was being said.
Yika, indeed.
Justice Strauss reached down to pat the child on the head. Sunny took Justice Strauss's hand and bit it gently.
That means she likes you.
She bites very, very hard if she doesn't like you, or if you want to give her a bath.
I see. Now then, how are you children getting on? Is there anything you desire?
The children looked at one another, thinking of all the things they desired. Another bed, for example. A proper crib for Sunny. Curtains for the window in their room. A closet instead of a cardboard box. But what they desired most of all, of course, was not to be associated with Count Olaf in any way whatsoever. What they desired most was to be with their parents again, in their true home. But that, of course, was impossible. Violet, Klaus, and Sunny all looked down at the floor unhappily as they considered the question. Finally, Klaus spoke.
Could we perhaps borrow a cookbook? Count Olaf has instructed us to make dinner for his theater troupe tonight, and we can't find a cookbook in the house.
Goodness, cooking dinner for an entire theater troupe seems like a lot to ask of children.
Count Olaf gives us a lot of responsibility.
Violet wanted to say, Count Olaf is an evil man, but she was well-mannered, so she did not.
Well, why don't you come next door to my house and find a cookbook that pleases you?
The youngsters agreed and followed Justice Strauss out the door and over to her well-kept house. She led them through an elegant hallway, smelling of flowers, into an enormous room. And when they saw what was inside, they nearly fainted from delight. The room was a library. Not a public library, but a private library. That is, a large collection of books belonging to Justice Strauss. There were shelves and shelves of them, on every wall, from the floor to the ceiling, and separate shelves, and shelves of them in the middle of the room. The only place there weren't books was in one corner, where there were some large, comfortable-looking chairs and a wooden table with lamps hanging over them, perfect for reading. Although it was not as big as their parents' library, it was as cozy, and the Baudelaire children were thrilled.
My word! This is a wonderful library.
Thank you very much. I have been collecting books for years, and I'm very proud of my collection. As long as you keep them in good condition, you are welcome to use any of my books at any time. Now, the cookbooks are over here on the eastern wall. Shall we have a look at them?
Yes. And then, if you don't mind, I should love to look at any of your books concerning mechanical engineering. Inventing things is a great interest of mine.
And I would like to look at books on wolves. Recently, I have been fascinated by the subject of wild animals of North America.
Book!
Which meant, please don't forget to pick out a picture book for me.
It is a pleasure to see young people interested in books. But first, I think we'd better find a good recipe, don't you?
The children agreed, and for 30 minutes or so, they perused several cookbooks that Justice Strauss recommended. To tell you the truth, the three orphans were so excited to be out of Count Olaf's house and in this pleasant library that they were a little distracted and unable to concentrate on cooking. But finally Klaus found a dish that sounded delicious and easy to make.
Listen to this. Puttanesca. It's an Italian sauce for pasta. All we need to do is sauté olives, capers, anchovies, garlic, chop parsley and tomatoes together in a pot, and prepare spaghetti to go with it.
That sounds easy.
The Baudelaire orphans looked at one another. Perhaps, with the kind Justice Strauss and her library right next door, the children could prepare pleasant lives for themselves as easily as making puttanesca sauce for Count Olaf. The Baudelaire orphans copied the puttanesca recipe from the cookbook onto a piece of scrap paper, and Justice Strauss was kind enough to escort them to the market to buy the necessary ingredients. Count Olaf had not left them very much money, but the children were able to buy everything they needed. From a street vendor, they purchased olives, after tasting several varieties and choosing their favorites. At a pasta store, they selected interestingly shaped noodles and asked the woman running the store the proper amount for 13 people, the 10 people Count Olaf mentioned and the three of them. Then, at the supermarket, they purchased garlic, which is a sharp-tasting bulbous plant, anchovies, which are a small salty fish, capers, which are flower buds of a small shrub and taste marvellous, and tomatoes, which are actually fruits and not vegetables, as most people believe. They thought it would be proper to serve dessert, and bought several envelopes of pudding mix. Perhaps, the orphans thought, if they made a delicious meal, Count Olaf might be a bit kinder to them. Then Violet and her siblings walked home with Justice Strauss.
Thank you so much for helping us out today, Justice Strauss. I don't know what we would have done without you.
You seem like very intelligent people. I dare say you would have thought of something. But it continues to strike me as odd that Count Olaf has asked you to prepare such an enormous meal. Well, here we are. I must go inside and put my own groceries away. I hope you children will come over soon and borrow books from my library.
Tomorrow? Could we come over tomorrow?
I don't see why not.
I can't tell you how much we appreciate this.
With their kind parents dead, and Count Olaf treating them so abominably, the three children were not used to kindness from adults, and they weren't sure if they were expected to do anything back.
Tomorrow, before we use your library again, Klaus and I would be more than happy to do household chores for you. Sunny isn't really old enough to work, but I'm sure we could find some way she could help you.
Justice Strauss smiled at the three children, but her eyes were sad. She reached out a hand and put it on Violet's hair, and Violet felt more comforted than she had in some time.
That won't be necessary. You are always welcome in my home.
She turned and went into her home, and after a moment of staring after her, the Baudelaire orphans went into theirs. For most of the afternoon, Violet, Klaus, and Sunny cooked the puttanesca sauce according to the recipe. Violet roasted the garlic and washed and chopped the anchovies. Klaus peeled the tomatoes and pitted the olives. Sunny banged on a pot with a wooden spoon, singing a rather repetitive song she had written herself, and all three of the children felt less miserable than they had since their arrival at Count Olaf's. The smell of cooking food is often a calming one, and the kitchen grew cozy as the sauce simmered, a culinary term which means cooked over low heat. The three orphans spoke of pleasant memories of their parents, and about Justice Strauss, who they agreed was a wonderful neighbour, and in whose library they planned to spend a great deal of time. As they talked, they mixed and tasted the chocolate pudding. Just as they were placing the pudding in the refrigerator to cool, Violet, Klaus, and Sunny heard a loud booming sound as the front door was flung open. And I'm sure I don't have to tell you who was home.
Orphans! Where are you, orphans?
In the kitchen, Count Olaf. We're just finishing dinner.
You'd better be. My troop is right behind me, and they are very hungry. Where is the roast beef?
We didn't make roast beef. We made puttanesca sauce.
What? No roast beef?
You didn't tell us you wanted roast beef.
Count Olaf slid toward the children so that he looked even taller than he was. His eyes grew even brighter, and his one eyebrow raised in anger.
In agreeing to adopt you, I have become your father, and as your father, I am not someone to be trifled with. I demand that you serve roast beef to myself and my guests.
We don't have any. We made puttanesca sauce. No! No! No!
Count Olaf looked down at Sunny, who had spoken so suddenly. With an inhuman roar, he picked her up in one scraggly hand and raised her high in the air so that she was staring at him in the eye. Needless to say, Sunny was very frightened and began crying immediately, too scared to even try to bite the hand that held her.
Put her down immediately, you beast!
Klaus jumped up, trying to rescue Sunny from the grasp of the Count, but he was holding her too high to reach. Count Olaf looked down at Klaus and smiled a terrible, toothy grin, raising the wailing Sunny up even higher in the air. He seemed about to drop her to the floor when there was a loud blast of laughter in the next room.
Olaf? Where's Olaf?
Count Olaf paused, still holding the wailing Sunny up in the air, as members of his theatre troupe walked into the kitchen.
I've never seen anything like it before.
Soon they were crowding the room. An assortment of strange-looking characters of all shapes and sizes. There was a bald man with a very long nose, dressed in a long black robe. There were two women who had bright white powder all over their faces, making them look like ghosts. Behind the women was a man with very long and skinny arms, at the end of which were two hooks instead of hands. There was a person who was extremely fat and who looked like neither a man nor a woman. And behind this person, standing in the doorway, were an assortment of people the children could not see, but who promised to be just as frightening.
Here you are, Olaf. What in the world are you doing?
I'm just disciplining these orphans. I asked them to make dinner, and all they have made is some disgusting sauce.
You can't go easy on children. They must be taught to obey their elders.
Are these those wealthy children you were telling me about?
Yes. They are so awful I can scarcely stand to touch them.
With that, he lowered Sunny, who was still wailing, to the floor. Violet and Klaus breathed a sigh of relief that he had not dropped her from that great height.
I don't blame you.
Count Olaf rubbed his hands together as if he had been holding something revolting instead of an infant.
Well, enough talk. I suppose we will eat their dinner, even though it is all wrong. Everyone, follow me to the dining room and I will pour us some wine. Perhaps by the time these brats serve us, we will be too drunk to care if it is roast beef or not.
Hurrah!
Some wine, yes.
They marched through the kitchen, following Count Olaf into the dining room. Nobody paid a bit of attention to the children, except for the bald man, who stopped and stared Violet in the eye.
You're a pretty one. If I were you, I would try not to anger Count Olaf, or he might wreck that pretty little face of yours.
Violet shuddered, and the bald man gave a high-pitched giggle and left the room. The Baudelaire children, alone in the kitchen, found themselves breathing heavily, as if they had just run a long distance. Sunny continued to wail, and Klaus found that his eyes were wet with tears as well. Only Violet didn't cry, but merely trembled with fear and revulsion. A word which here means an unpleasant mixture of horror and disgust. For several moments, none of them could speak.
This is terrible! Terrible! Violet, what can we do?
I don't know. I'm afraid.
Me too!
Fox!
Let's have some dinner!
The theater troupe began pounding on the table in strict rhythm, which is an exceedingly rude thing to do.
We'd better serve the puttanesca, or who knows what Count Olaf will do to us.
Violet thought of what the bald man had said about wrecking her face, and nodded. The two of them looked at the pot of bubbling sauce, which had seemed so cozy while they were making it, and now looked like a vat of blood. Then, leaving Sunny behind in the kitchen, they walked into the dining room, Klaus carrying a bowl of the interestingly shaped noodles, and Violet carrying the pot of puttanesca sauce and a large ladle with which to serve it. The theater troupe was talking and cackling and drinking again and again from their wine cups and paying no attention to the Baudelaire orphans as they circled the table, serving everyone dinner. Violet's right hand ached from holding the heavy ladle. She thought of switching to her left hand, but because she was right-handed, she was afraid she might spill the sauce with her left hand, which could enrage Count Olaf again. She stared miserably at Olaf's plate of food and found herself wishing she had bought poison at the market and put it in the puttanesca sauce. Finally, they were through serving, and Klaus and Violet slipped back into the kitchen. They listened to the wild, rough laughter of Count Olaf and his theater troupe, and they picked at their own portions of food, too miserable to eat. Before long, Olaf's friends were pounding on the table in strict rhythm again, and the orphans went out to the dining room to clear the table, and then again to serve the chocolate pudding. By now it was obvious that Count Olaf and his associates had drunk a great deal of wine, and they slouched at the table and spoke much less. Finally, they roused themselves and trooped back through the kitchen, scarcely glancing at the children on their way out of the house. Count Olaf looked around the room, which was filled with dirty dishes.
Because you haven't cleaned up yet, I suppose you can be excused from attending tonight's performance. But after cleaning up, you are to go straight to your beds.
Klaus had been staring at the floor, trying to hide how upset he was. But at this, he couldn't remain silent.
You mean our bed! You have only provided us with one bed!
Huh?
What did he say?
Members of the theater troupe stopped in their tracks at this outburst and glanced from Klaus to Count Olaf to see what would happen next. Count Olaf raised his one eyebrow, and his eyes shone bright, but he spoke calmly.
If you would like another bed, tomorrow you may go into town and purchase one.
You know perfectly well we haven't any money.
Of course you do. You are the inheritors of an enormous fortune.
That money is not to be used until Violet is of age.
Count Olaf's face grew very red. For a moment he said nothing. Then in one sudden movement he reached down and struck Klaus across the face.
Ah!
Klaus fell to the floor, his face inches from the eye tattooed on Olaf's ankle. His glasses leaked from his face and skittered into a corner. His left cheek, where Olaf had struck him, felt as if it were on fire. The theater troupe laughed, and a few of them applauded as if Count Olaf had done something very brave instead of something despicable.
Come on, friends. We'll be late for our own performance.
If I know you, Olaf, you'll figure out a way to get at that Baudelaire money.
We'll see.
Count Olaf's eyes were shining bright, as if he already had an idea. There was another boom as the front door shut behind Count Olaf and his friends, and the Baudelaire children were alone in the kitchen. Violet knelt at Klaus's side, giving him a hug to try to make him feel better. Sonny crawled over to his glasses, picked them up and brought them to him. Klaus began to sob, not so much from the pain, but from rage at the terrible situation they were in. Violet and Sonny cried with him, and they continued weeping as they washed the dishes, and as they blew out the candles in the dining room, and as they changed out of their clothes and lay down to go to sleep. Klaus in the bed, Violet on the floor, Sunny on her little cushion of curtains. The moonlight shone through the window, and if anyone had looked into the Baudelaire orphan's bedroom, they would have seen three children crying quietly all night long. Unless you have been very, very lucky, you have undoubtedly experienced events in your life that have made you cry. So, unless you have been very, very lucky, you know that a good long session of weeping can often make you feel better, even if your circumstances have not changed one bit. So it was with the Baudelaire orphans. Having cried all night, they rose the next morning feeling as if a weight were off their shoulders. The three children knew, of course, that they were still in a terrible situation, but they thought they might do something to make it better.
Clearly, we cannot stay here any longer. I would rather take my chances on the streets than live in this terrible place.
But who knows what misfortunes would befall us on the streets. At least here we have a roof over our heads.
I wish our parents' money could be used now, instead of when you come of age. Then we could buy a castle and live in it, with armed guards patrolling the outside to keep out Count Olaf and his troop.
And I could have a large inventing studio.
Violet swung the axe down and split a log neatly in two.
Filled with gears and pulleys and wires and an elaborate computer system.
And I could have a large library, as comfortable as Justice Strauss's, but more enormous.
Kibble!
Which appeared to mean, and I could have lots of things to bite.
But in the meantime, we have to do something about our predicament.
Perhaps Justice Strauss could adopt us. She said we were always welcome in her home.
But she meant for a visit or to use her library. She didn't mean to live.
Perhaps if we explained our situation to her, she would agree to adopt us.
But when Violet looked at Klaus, she saw that he knew it was of no use. Adoption is an enormous decision, and not likely to happen impulsively. I'm sure you, in your life, have occasionally wished to be raised by different people than the ones who are raising you, but knew in your heart that the chances of this were very slim.
I think we should go see Mr. Poe. He told us when he dropped us here that we could contact him at the bank if we had any questions.
We don't really have a question. We have a complaint.
Ugh!
He was thinking of Mr. Poe walking toward them at Briny Beach with his terrible message. Even though the fire was, of course, not Mr. Poe's fault, Klaus was reluctant to see Mr. Poe because he was afraid of getting more bad news.
I can't think of anyone else to contact. Mr. Poe is in charge of our affairs, and I'm sure if he knew how horrid Count Olaf is, he would take us right out of here.
Klaus pictured Mr. Poe arriving in his car and putting the Baudelaire orphans inside to go somewhere else, and felt a stirring of hope. Anywhere would be better than here.
Okay, let's get this firewood all chopped and we'll go to the bank.
Invigorated by their plan, the Baudelaire orphans swung their axes at an amazing speed, and soon enough they were done chopping firewood and ready to go to the bank. They remembered Count Olaf saying he had a map of the city, and they looked thoroughly for it, but they couldn't find any trace of a map, and decided it must be in the tower, where they were forbidden to go. So, without directions of any sort, the Baudelaire children set off for the city's banking district, in hopes of finding Mr. Poe. After walking through the meat district, the flower district, and the sculpture district, the three children arrived at the banking district, pausing to take a refreshing sip of water at the fountain of victorious finance. The banking district consisted of several wide streets with large marble buildings on each side of them, all banks. They went first to Trustworthy Bank, and then to Faithful Savings and Loan, and then to Subservient Financial Services, each time inquiring for Mr. Poe. Finally, a receptionist at Subservient said she knew that Mr. Poe worked down the street at Mulctuary Money Management. The building was square and rather plain-looking, though once inside, the three orphans were intimidated by the hustle and bustle of the people as they raced around the large, echoey room. Finally, they asked a uniformed guard whether they had arrived at the right place to speak to Mr. Poe, and he led them into a large office with many file cabinets and no windows.
Why, hello.
Mr. Poe was sitting at a desk covered in typed papers that looked important and boring. Surrounding a small framed photograph of his wife and his two beastly sons were three telephones with flashing lights.
Please come in.
Thank you.
Klaus shook Mr. Poe's hand. The Baudelaire youngsters sat down in three large and comfortable chairs.
I'm very busy today, so I don't have too much time to chat. Next time you should call ahead of time when you plan on being in the neighborhood, and I will put some time aside to take you to lunch.
That would be very pleasant, and we're sorry we didn't contact you before we stopped by, but we find ourselves in an urgent situation.
Count Olaf is a madman. We cannot stay with him.
He struck Klaus across the face. See his bruise?
Excuse me. Poe here. What? Yes. 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 No. Yes. Thank you. I'm sorry. What were we talking about? Oh, yes, Count Olaf. I'm sorry you don't have a good first impression of him.
He has only provided us with one bed.
He makes us do a great many difficult chores.
He drinks too much wine?
Excuse me. Poe here. Seven. 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 Six and a half. Seven. You're welcome.
He hung up and quickly wrote something down on one of his papers, then looked at the children.
I'm sorry, what were you saying about Count Olaf?